This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Pigs are a beloved part of North Carolina culture and vital to the state's economy, but their international reputation is a little bit more divided. I mean, in many places around the world, pigs are thought of as filthy and lazy. Pork is prohibited by a number of religions and has also been disparaged at a number of points in American culinary history. So what's the real deal with the pig? Well, my guest today has been on a quest to figure that out. In the new book, Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig, historian Mark Essig argues that we have loved and hated pigs for as long as they have lived among us. He examines pig biology and traces 10,000 years of human culture to examine how the clever, versatile animal ended up with such a complex reputation. Mark Essig is an Asheville-based writer and a historian, and he joins me now from WCQS in Asheville. Hello, Mark. Welcome to the State of Things.
Hi, Frank. Good to be here.
Of course, pigs have been around for a long time, but their relationship with humans started when humans began to settle down and domesticate crops and animals. Tell us how the two of us got together in this relationship.
Well, pigs emerged from a creature called the Eurasian wild boar that lives all across Eurasia, at one point from Southeast Asia all the way up to England. And about 10,000 years ago, which was when farming first got started, people started settling down into villages. And when people get together in groups, one of the things they're best at is producing garbage. And these wild boar were very quick to discover this, and some of them started slinking into town to eat that human garbage. And eventually, over hundreds or maybe thousands of years, the pigs that were best at filling this new ecological niche, the ones that didn't threaten humans yet were bold enough to walk among them, they evolved into an entirely new creature that we call the domestic pig.
And you point out in your book that the pig is unique in this in the sense that it is an omnivore, and unlike other animals, herbivores, the cows that we ultimately domesticated, and maybe dogs who are carnivores, these pigs ate everything, and that made them well suited to pick through our garbage.
Yeah, that's exactly right. When you think about the history of cows or sheep, you can pretty much be sure that you would find them for thousands of years standing in fields eating grass. That's about all they do. But pigs, you would find them on seashores eating mussels and clams, in the woods eating acorns, in fields eating corn and other grains, but very often on city streets scavenging garbage.
What about the relationship before? I mean, you talked about wild boars, so I'm guessing that human populations, hunters, encountered these animals and found them tasty. Am I right? Did they hunt them?
They did. There's some very old archaeological digs dating back before the Neolithic, before the era of farming, where you do find that that people were hunting boar. They wild boar are generally creatures of the woods. They live in small groups called sounders. So to hunt these animals, it probably would have been an ambush situation. Or it's possible that they were hunted with dogs, much as modern-day hunters in the far west of North Carolina hunt wild pigs with dogs. But we don't have good evidence for the details of that.
Now, they were sorting through garbage and eating that, and I'm wondering what those early settled human populations thought of this animal in terms of its, as a culinary possibility.
When archaeologists dig up these sites dating back 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 years ago, they find that pretty much everywhere in the Near East, talking what we call the Middle East today, as well as in China, just about every settled village, they were raising pigs and eating pork. But then starting about 3,000 years ago, you got the rise of the first civilizations, first in Mesopotamia and slightly later in Egypt. And almost as soon as we get written records and better archaeological evidence, you find evidence that there is some worries arising surrounding pigs. You find that nobody is sacrificing pigs to their gods. Nobody is using them as temple offerings. And people who can afford to eat other things, we're talking about priests, bureaucrats, the upper classes, perhaps, they are not eating pigs. You still find pigs around, but they tend to be found in the areas of these cities where poorer people live. Mm. So you see a social differentiation. When you get civilizations, you get social classes, and pigs were very quickly consigned to the lower orders.
All right. And would this be because of their diet? Do we know why?
It seems to be so. Yeah, you get indications that pigs defile the temple, and it has largely to do with what they were eating. I find it's useful to compare them to ancient Rome, which had a very different relationship to pigs, which probably loved pigs more than any people before or since have ever loved pigs. And, you know, it's just around the corner of the Mediterranean there. But the difference, I think, is that Rome, it was a wealthier empire. It could afford to feed them grains that they imported or requisitioned from other areas. It was a wetter country, so that there were oak forests where the pigs could eat acorns. Whereas in the Near East, the only suitable pig habitat was in city streets. They were wallowing in filth. They were eating garbage and worse things, including human waste. And so they were considered filthy. And I find that's a thread you can trace through the 10,000-year history of domestic pigs. What we think of them depends a lot on how they are living. When they live clean lives and eat clean things, we like them. When they live dirty lives and eat filth, we tend to reject them.
So the domestication is important, and obviously if you're really sort of farming them and taking care of them and feeding them deliberately, then you have a much, much different opinion. And I think this plays out in a very interesting distinction that we find linguistically pointed out, as you point out in your book, in the book Ivanhoe. But it's a distinction that I think a lot of us have been curious about. If we speak English, why we talk about pigs as animals and pork as meat, and it's a distinction that plays out in the novel, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's an exchange that happens when regarding the terms that we use to refer to the animals as opposed to the meat. Pig, cow, those are old Anglo-Saxon terms. Those are the people who are raising the animals. But when you transform them into meat, then you use the French terms, pork, beef, mutton. Those are all derived from the French terms for those words. And it seems to be, as the exchange goes in the novel Ivanhoe, that when they are cared for by the Saxon slaves, they go by pig. But when they are carried into the dining hall to be feasted on by nobles, they become pork. And that's really an indication of not only the regard these animals were held in, but also who got to eat meat. Usually the meat was something that only the wealthiest could afford, and peasants tended to eat mostly grains.
And that distinction in English would have happened probably after the Norman Conquest, when the French were the upper class, the aristocracy, and the Saxons were taking care of their swine. So
precisely that famous event of 1066.
1066, one of the few dates I still remember. but also the prohibition. I mean, you talked about this class distinction happening somewhere around 3,000 years ago as civilizations arise and we have a real hierarchy of a priestly class and a ruling class. But Judaism, the Mosaic law, had prohibited this for all people under Jewish law. Tell us about that and the interesting relationship between Jews and Christians and, as you mentioned earlier, the Romans, the fact that they loved swine and pork.
The book of Leviticus is where the formal prohibition on pork among the Jewish people was first set down. And it perhaps about 700 or 800 BC is when that happened, although it's not definitive. The interesting thing is that nearly none of the upper classes, the priests in the Near East, were eating pork at that time. So that prohibition would not have surprised any of the Israelites' neighbors. And there's very few mentions of it. After that initial prohibition, it doesn't come up a lot. It's only after the Greeks and later the Romans become the rulers of Palestine that pork becomes a central issue of Jewish identity. And when you think about it, that really makes sense. If none of your neighbors are eating pork, then the issue doesn't come up. When Greeks and Romans who embraced pork, who loved pork, came around and started setting the rules, it really became a central matter of Jewish identity. And you can see this in the books of the Maccabees, this is the story that the origin story that is celebrated in Hanukkah, in which Jews were forced or tried to be forced to eat pork, and they refused and were killed for it. And so this was the period when pork eating became so central. Who was a Jew? A Jew was a person who refused to eat pork. And if you wanted to remain loyal to your God, loyal to your people, then you had to uphold this law.
And you made the interesting point that when Christianity, when the followers of Christ broke from the Jewish faith, they then would embrace pork. And if Romans loved pork, perhaps that's the one reason that they came ultimately, 300 years later, to be embraced by the Romans.
Yeah, I think that that certainly is a factor of it. I mean, it's central to Christianity that it's a world-embracing religion. It's not about remaining pure to your tribe in your holy land. It's about embracing all peoples all over the world. And it's hard to imagine Romans embracing Christianity if Christianity had not first embraced pork. And it's part of the wider Christian rejection of Jewish laws. But there's one thing about food. It's food habits are very sticky. It's hard to shake them off. And even among Christians who had a formal, who were formerly allowed to eat pork, you can see throughout the centuries sort of reservations about whether they really should or not.
I'm talking to Mark Essig, who's the author of Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig, which plays an important part in the colonial history of North America as well. Tell us about that.
Pigs were emerged from, as we said before, from Eurasian wild boar. They didn't live in the Americas. They first came on Columbus's second voyage. And on that voyage, Columbus took just about every creature and every plant to recreate the old world diet in the new world. And nearly everything failed at first because he was settled in the West Indies, where the climate was not really compatible, except for pigs. Pigs, as soon as their sharp little hooves landed in the jungle mud, they started reproducing like crazy. And within a decade or two, you start getting complaints that they were swarming like vermin upon the land. But really, it wasn't really a complaint. What it meant was they had an abundant food supply that was vital to the Spanish conquest of the New World. Probably the most important factor was European diseases, which wiped out maybe as much as 90% of the native population of the New World before these people even encountered a European in person. But after that, you could make the case that the pig was the most important because it allowed the Spanish to eat. When Cortes took his troops to the mainland to attack the civilizations there, he rode with horses, he rode with dogs, and then trailing behind there would be a herd of pigs. And that meant that the soldiers who had to travel on their stomachs would have something to eat along the way. And then you see the similar process happening in North America. The self-sufficiency of pigs was vital. Farmers had a lot to do. They had to clear roads, plant crops, build houses. They didn't have a lot of time for the sort of careful forms of animal livestock tending that were practiced in England. But instead, they just turned their pigs loose in the woods. The pigs took care of themselves, and then they could be killed in the fall, salted away for the winter.
And as we can infer from all you're saying, I mean, they traveled with soldiers. They were able to go from farm to farm. And as the farmland expanded, they went with them. They traveled well, right?
Yeah, that's actually how I first got into this topic. I moved to Asheville about 8 years ago, and there's statues of pigs in the center of town. So I started reading about the history of pigs, and I discovered that back in the 19th century, there would be tens of thousands of pigs, as many as 150,000 in 1 year, walking through the center of Asheville on the hoof. They started in East Tennessee, where there was a little mini corn belt, and they ended in South Carolina and Georgia, where there were a lot of slaves who needed to eat. And so they walked. The only way to get from here to there was over the Blue Ridge Mountains. And so the pigs walked. And my first reaction was simply delight. You know, everybody's heard about cattle drives, but who's heard about pig drives? Who knew that a pig could walk that far? Who knew that they would go in the direction you would want them to go? So I followed that story. And yeah, it's one of the many miraculous things about pigs. They are very mobile. They have been herded just about everywhere people have gone.
And we do know that we eat more pork here in the South. Has that always been true? And what about these class distinctions? How have they followed us from that period 3,000 years ago?
I think they have followed us. Of course, there's always transformations. The expressions about eating high on the hog versus low on the hog. The most prestigious cuts tended to be pork chops from the loin high on the pig, or hams, whereas the lower on the hog would be intestines, chitlins, bacon, that sort of thing. And, I mean, the reason pork has always been so central to the Southern diet was that a lot of people kept pigs. Even today, when I've been traveling around talking about my book with people, I'll find lots of people who aren't particularly old who will tell me that their grandparents or their parents, they kept hogs in the woods and they would slaughter them on the farm. So we're a little bit closer to the land here in the South. And I think a pig can be a very household-based livestock in a way that cows cannot, just because they're much smaller. You can feed them on slops, you can feed them on fruit from your orchards or acorns from the woods. And so it's always been, there's always been a more intimate relationship with pigs. They tend to live around the house. We tend to butcher them and salt them ourselves. And that has continued to be true in the South, much more so than elsewhere in the country.
And let's talk about some of the myths. They're a lot smarter than we give them credit for, aren't they?
Yeah, that's been recognized going back quite a while. The ancient Roman writer Pliny the Elder tells a story about pigs on board a ship that was listing to one side, and he claims that the pigs ran over to the high side of the ship to balance out the cargo. I'm not sure we can believe that story, but it's certainly an indication of what people thought about pigs. In the more modern sense, there's cognitive scientists who have determined that pigs can figure out how mirrors work and use them to scan a landscape. They've found that if a pig knows where food is hidden, it won't dig it up until there are no other pigs around, so it doesn't have to share that cache of food. And there's lots of interesting explanations for this as well. I think my favorite has to do with what's called the expensive tissue hypothesis. There's certain bodily functions that require a lot of calories. And because a cow, for instance, digests cellulose, which is very energy intensive, it has to give a lot of its metabolic energy to the gut. Whereas pigs, because they're eating calorie-dense foods like meat, seeds, grains, they can devote more of their energy to their brain. And it's the similar explanation of why humans develop larger brains. We eat calorie-dense foods, and we can afford to think a little bit more.
Well, let's talk about modern hog production, especially factory farming and commercial hog production. You talk about that in terms of the impact on the pig itself. Obviously, the taste of the meat and all that, anybody who's had both knows the difference. But the animal itself, particularly its snout, I was surprised to see how important the snout is in ways I hadn't expected to the pig, and how factory farming affects pigs and hogs.
It's best to think of snouts not really as a nose, but more like a smaller version of an elephant's trunk. The part of the pig's brain that is wired to the sense of touch, in humans, that part of the brain is wired mostly to our fingers, because that's how we experience the world. With pigs, almost all of those nerves are wired to the snout, because that's its main interface with the world. It's how it nuzzles its mother. It's how it roots around in the ground for food. It's how it plays. And in modern industrial hog farming, most of these pigs spend their entire lives living on hard, slatted floors surrounded by metal bars. The only soft things around tend to be other pigs. And this leads to some unfortunate behaviors where, like, biting of the pigs biting the tails of other pigs. So really, people who are thinking about better ways to treat pigs, one important aspect of that is giving these pigs something to do with their snouts. When you think about pigs, I've spent some time on pig farms, and they really act a lot like dogs in their playfulness, in their curiosity. And when you think about the fact that most pigs are slaughtered at about 6 months of age, we're really talking about puppies. So when you think about a puppy being confined to a place where it really has nothing to do, no way to express its natural behaviors, I think that's problematic.
Fascinating stuff. Wish we had more time, Mark. Good to talk with you. Mark Essig, who has written the book, Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org, and our thanks to WCQS in Asheville, where Mark was sitting while we were talking. Just ahead, we preview a new play that explores race, privilege, and the lesser-known history of affluent African-American culture on Martha's Vineyard. Please stay with us.